Well, I'm happy to introduce Lillian. Thank you for being here and sharing with us today. The floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for all who invited me to this group to speak. My name is Lil or Lillian. I'm an alcoholic. And like I always say, I got to wake up sober because of people just like all of you. All your experiences have shown me the benefits of not drinking. And it's really nice to go to bed sober and just magically, it seems, though not really magically, wake up sober and fill the day with stuff, life stuff. I got just for background, I got sober in 88 in Manhattan, which is a really great place to get sober because there's so many meetings. You could just throw a dead rat and you'll out the window and you'll find a meeting. It's they're that close, or you take the subway or you walk, and it's a great place for fellowship because all the restaurants that are there and diners and whatnot. And so I got sober there. And but prior to that, I grew up in Sacramento, California, which is, those of you that are familiar, it's right smack dab between San Francisco and the Sierras. Can I say? I did most of my drinking in Oakland and San Francisco. Really heavy drinking, not knowing what to do. I got a grant to go to art school and the California College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland. And I haven't planned anything, but the one thing I was thinking about is how our, and I'm sure we all have gone through this, how our families have influenced our behavior, our emotions. It's not a new thing to say that we got, really fucked up from our families. I mean, I guess there are some people who had delightful families and they still drank and they overdrank, and now they're visiting the rooms because they can't stop drinking. Most of us, I believe, have come from the front lines of, society's battlefields. And I know I chose to drink because I didn't have a clue how to behave in public, how to behave with people. I didn't know how to start a conversation or end a conversation. I felt I was always the stupidest one in the room. When I was a kid, I wasn't able to read until I was seven. And I don't know why they didn't address it at that age. Back then in the late 50s, those things were just, there wasn't any interest or funding, or nobody knew what to do. And I think because I was quiet, well behaved, and because I could draw really well and decorate the teacher's walls with beautiful turkeys for Thanksgiving and Christmas trees for Christmas and Valentine's in February, they let me stay. And then somehow I started looking at the words in the book, and something clicked. I don't know why, how I started reading. It was certainly a struggle. Arithmetic was not my friend. But yet, when I got sober, somebody suggested that I go on welfare so I could go to school and that the welfare would pay for it. And which I did. I went to first, I went to this program called EPRA, which stood for Employment Program for Recovering Alcoholics. And it was like a 12-week emotional boot camp. They really put me through the ringer and everybody through the ringer. If you were literally 1 second late to one of the classes, you were out, because that was one of the reasons why people had a hard time staying employed. The stuff we learned when we were drinking, to, I'm going to show up late, I don't give a shit about what, I don't care. it carries over into our sober lives. They'd like to take people who had about a year and a half of sobriety, so they were more established in the program. So if you were just a minute late, a second late, you goodbye, go home. And one of the things that I, after going to EPRA and doing that, which was most excellent program, it was in Manhattan, they had it. I got on welfare and went to a community college. And fortunately, there was funding at this community college, LaGuardia Community College out in Queens, where they had a, what would you call it? A place where they, tested people for learning difficulties. I don't want to say disabilities because that's kind of weird. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'm just saying that, we all have our stuff. And I got tested and I found out that I had some kind of thing where the audio thing was like off like a second. If I heard a word like disturbance, or demolish or something, my brain would try to figure it out before I, could listen any further. And by that time, the person who's speaking to me, usually a teacher, or someone older, would just keep going on, and I would have this blank look on my face. And it had that kind of like that stupid look on the face. And it was not a lot of fun, feeling behind in my life. And once I realized this, they gave me, like more time to take tests, and they really were helpful. It was really helped clarify why I was the way I was when I was a kid. And so that was really great to learn that. And why do I bring that up? I think because families are odd. I mean, depending on what era we grew up in, if we were, I was on a chairlift, a gondola actually, and my wife and I, we were much older, and everybody in there was born after 2000. I don't get it. I was born last year in the mid-century, right? Like a lot of us here. And I know I've accumulated a lot of interesting baggage from childhood because I was raised by people who didn't have this program. My father was the alcoholic. My mother was the super codependent. And my brother was also an alcoholic. And the two men died of alcoholism and all the diseases that cause alcoholism. My mother died of cancer from being so codependent. And also that my parents gambled. And from Sacramento to Reno is about 2 hours. And we would go on Highway 80 across the Sierras, whether it was a blizzard or a blistering heat. My father would put the chains on the car because they, at Donner Summit was the highest point on 80, where the state troopers would stop all the cars and trucks and say, "You can't go any further in a blizzard." I mean, in a blizzard, you can't go any further unless you put your chains on. My father would get out and put the chains on, in this blizzard snow to go to Reno so that they could go gambling, and they would stick me and my brother in the theater. We would watch double features back then, so we would watch movies like 2.5 times. So we were in there from like 10:30 to like 11, and we were like a lot of kids there with their parents, just bopping about. And so that's I guess that's not common. We all have, histories of family that we look back, go, that's not common. That not a lot of families did that. And we also, because they gambled a lot, we moved around a lot. And I remember once sitting down with my mom and asking her, "How many times did we move?" And then I was 18 years old when I asked this question, and we had moved 20 times within a very small area because we were so broke and tried to evade getting evicted. So we would leave before we got officially evicted, and we just moved about all the time. Never had a swear to God, never had a bed. I slept on the couch or on one of those folding cots the aluminum ones. And it was interesting. And I guess it's not common, and yet at the same time, it's not uncommon what our histories are. And I know somebody here will identify with something that I'm saying. They go, oh yeah, I blah 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 blah, you know. And that's what I like about coming to AA is that I find that I am not alone in my stories, and which makes me unspecial and special at the same time, you know, that like I can share my experience to somebody that they can identify with growing up, or go like, wow, I didn't know, you know, that kind of things. And I mean, there's so many things that happened to people, you know, abusive childhood. I wouldn't call my upbringing abusive. I would call it neglectful childhood. And you know, Sacramento has its good points, its bad points. And one of the weird things about talking about family, my family, is that because my father was an alcoholic and he didn't want to be near his own family, which was in Southern California, and also Arizona. I never saw any friends come over. My mother's friends from the cannery, my father's friends from he was a construction laborer. My brother never brought over his close friend George, and I learned not to bring anybody over to the house. So I never had any social skills, you know, mi casa, su casa. I didn't get, never got a chance to use that phrase. And so, and so th that was a kind of a very interesting thing, because when I got the grant to go to art school, I was on my own. I was, if I didn't know anything, if I was a flea and I saw a dog, I wouldn't even know to jump on the dog. I had no skills whatsoever. But I did see people drinking and the other college students. And so we would go to the, this was in, Oakland is right next to Berkeley. So it's a big college town there. And it was so easy to drink and get high because pot rained. You know, you could buy a nickel bag. Remember those things? A nickel bag, and just get wasted all the time and pretend we're doing artwork, you know. So I never had those social skills, and when I came to AA, I realized that it's really a social thing, and it's, that skill levels had to be. For me, I understood they had to be developed. I was not a social butterfly. When I got drunk is when I got funny and loud and obnoxious. I didn't know, I couldn't read the room, that sort of thing. In AA, I learned to read the room. I learned to respond differently. I because we're told not to, what's the word? Don't judge another person. Just, leave them alone. And the beautiful thing about AA, certainly the traditional AA, is that when a person starts sharing, no one can interrupt them unless they've, gone off the rails or something, start throwing chairs and things. Of course, you want to tackle them or, I remember going to a meeting in Manhattan, Midnight Madness. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, Midnight Madness. And they earned that madness part. It was just called Midnight. Now, then they added Midnight Madness because you'd see people come in high as a kite doing push-ups in the middle of the floor while the speaker's talking at the little podium. And this was not uncommon there for things to happen. And again, I had to learn to, be very accepting of people. And then over time, of course, as a kid, as a kid, when like I said, my mother didn't invite any people into the house. And the house wasn't exactly super, super messy, but it wasn't quite just bumping its ass to a hoarder's, you know, just bumping its ass to being a hoarder's, but not quite, you know. And I remember a time, this will get to the secular part. I remember a time when I guess on the roll at school, they say, well, these are little Mexican kids, blah blah blah. They must be Catholic. Let's go see if they have to go to they have to go to Holy Com what's it Holy Communion or something, their first Holy Communion. Is it the whole thing with the wafers and the blood and the body of Christ, all that stuff? And I remember I was at me and my mom were at the house and knock on the door, and you could see through the door that it was a priest. And like the old movies, like World War II, where they throw the was it the torch in the air, or the flare in the air, and the soldiers would have to freeze so they wouldn't get shot down. They would have to look like trees and bushes. You remember those movies? You just kind of freeze. When the priest knocked on the door, we froze in our positions. I remember my mother was in the kitchen. I was in the hall. We just froze. Don't move. Don't move. And then he walked away. And we went, ah. So he came three times. On the third time, my mother had to answer the door. I guess she felt the neighbors were watching. And off I went to catechism, which was a total riot and a total joke to me as a little kid. And went through the whole thing, put on with little starchy dresses on with a little hat, you know, and went to confession. I didn't know what to confess. I didn't do anything. Made up lies so I could just go through to confession. And so when I first came into the rooms, you know, a lot of my artwork was based on the rebellion I had around Catholicism and that whole belief system. And I was just, you know, it's really weird when you don't really have people to talk to, how you internalize your own conversations and make up your own theories, you know, and whatnot. But when I was getting older, I would do artwork that was like anti-Catholicism, anti-Virgin Mary, and anything, you know. It was during the women's movement in the 70s, that period. Everything was happening. The gay movement was just happening. Boom. Everything was after that horrible period in 69 with, you know, with everybody getting assassinated that I admired. So it was a really interesting time. And then, so I was totally, anti, religion, organizations like that, and poo-pooed it. And I was very ignorant in how I expressed that. I didn't have any understanding about anything really. So I come into the rooms, and then there's the shades with the God all over, and everybody's complaining about God this, God that. And I said, well, maybe I'm one of those people too, and maybe it's because I didn't, you know, hug the feet of Christ or something. Maybe that's why I'm an alcoholic. Maybe that's why I'm here, because blah blah blah, I'm a, you know, bad person. I had no clue. And so I really struggled with all that, with all that references to higher power and God and whatnot for about 5 years. And remember, I got sober in 88. So, and then it came to a point where I just shut up. I didn't say anything about what I was hearing. I just, you know, accepted. They would do the Lord's Prayer at some meetings. They would read, what you call it, how it works, and at the very bottom to the agnostic, blah blah blah, and to the atheist, you know, someday you're going to get it, and so this will guarantee your sobriety. And I was just kind of cringe every time that part was read. Like, what do you mean I can't have my own belief system? What do you? I don't get it. I went to a couple of We Agnostic meetings. I think they were at the in Manhattan, and it was, I guess, in 88, I guess 89 maybe, and everybody seemed very angry about God, and they were, because somebody somebody approached this man and said, "You have to believe this." And they were just furious. And there was such rage in the rooms. And I said, "I don't want rage." And so I stopped going there. And again, I kept quiet and I would listen to people talk about how they, and I was sober. I was getting sober, staying sober. I found ways to stay sober. I had my rhythms, my patterns, my groups to go to, my meetings to go to, my fellowship that I would enjoy going to. But this one thing just started, kept bothering me and bothering me. Then I learned about my ancestry is like, according to ancestry.com, I'm like 54% indigenous. I love that word, indigenous, like I'm a cicada getting ready to pop out of the ground, the indigenous person from the Southwest. Which get fueled me into examining my own motives and like what is bothering me. And I remember once being at a meeting when I was getting really into like my last name might be a Apache, but I don't think so. It would be cool if it was, but it's uncertain. Is that I that you know they we stand up, we hold hand. Would you like to close the meeting, Lil? Okay, and I said out of the blue, I said, "Let's great spirit." And everybody just went bling. They all like so there's springs out of the body popped out like bling. I don't know what to do with this. Okay, we'll go along with this. And I felt like a fraud because I wasn't raised in any of those traditions, any of those. I didn't have a grandmother who knew those traditions. And yet, I mean, look at me. And so I remember doing artwork that was kind of, exploring and celebrating that kind of ancestry of mine, whatever it was. What am I getting at is that there was a lot of exploration. And I think a lot of us do that, whether, we come from Europe or, Brazil or, China. We are, people who have gone all over the world and we're here now in our bodies. And there's a lot of, I know, thoughts and questions about all that. So mine was around that. And then because of that, because I felt phony when I said great spirit, I tried it twice and both I got the same flat response in my gut that that's not the right thing to say. And then a few years later, I realized that I'm a hybrid. I'm neither this nor that. And I started doing more research on the history of Native people and how it came about that who we are, what we are. And I learned a lot and there was really no other pathway for me is to be this hybrid of a person. English is, if you think of it, English is not my first language. Spanish is not my first language. And because of the colonization that the Spanish did, their influence of moving people about, separating tribes so they can work in the silver mines and the copper mines, build missions and buildings and mansions and things around. I have no idea who my people are. And my parents didn't want me to speak Spanish because they knew that English was king and wanted me to only speak English. So I was am not bilingual that way. I can hear it and understand it a little bit because they got to speak Spanish. But young Lillian, she's going to speak English because, we want her to advance. So they were promoting the colonizers, the invaders, if you will, as I like to think of it. And they were successful. And I'm neither this nor that. I'm actually a hybrid of all of that history. And when I did my ancestry.com thing, I found out that I have a lot of North African, like 18%. And also Iberia at the time, which is now Spain, I had like 21% or something like that. I also from the Senegal area. So there's that. I forgot what that percentage was, 7% or something. And so that told me that was actually the movement of my ancestors through colonization. The interesting story about the North African, I'm very proud of that. My ancestors were probably Moors that came into Spain, very intelligent people who brought civilization to that area at that time, with schools and buildings and literature and music, and when in 1492, when Columbus sailed the blue, that was the time that the Inquisition started. And that was the time when the Spanish people wanted, or the Catholics wanted to get rid of all the Moors because, we were Muslims, we were Arabs, and what they would either do, they would either, kill them, put them in prison, or send them off on ships with that Columbus had started, coming back and forth. And they said, there's wealth over there. So, Queen Isabella and all those people started sending ships over, and they would put the Moors on there as well because they were educated. They knew about, surveying and math. They were intelligent people, but they couldn't stay in Spain. And so somehow all that happened, and I'm very proud of that. And yet it didn't stop me from drinking. It stopped me from becoming an alcoholic. But it did fill my history of self, an explanation of where I came from, even if though it's just a story. You don't know if I'm making this up as I'm talking to you. You'd have no idea. But I for me has offered me a sense of self-understanding, self-appreciation. Some things make sense. I don't know who saw who and who married who and who raped who or who this or that, but here I am. I'm I just turned 70. I've been sober for like 35 plus years. This North African skis. She plays pickleball, she enjoys herself. She owns a house. I didn't never thought I could own a house. I'm married. Life is pretty good. And the thing about the religious part of I realized that because of my own research into my background of, because of that research into my background, I was able to let go of what I was seeing because I knew that there were so many things around me that were false and untrue, that were fed to us and lies that were told to everybody, and when I speak to people who are suffering, it's going to sound weird, who are suffering from knowing that they're privileged. They say, "Oh, we're so sorry. We annihilated the native population, and we're so sorry." I said, "I think don't be sorry. Those were lies that were told to you as well. You were doing this because the church said, literally said, go and take what you want in the name of, whatever country was being represented." At that time on the East Coast, it was England, the Dutch, the French, and the Spanish, not so much. They were like in Florida, but and Mexico, the islands. We all suffer from the powers that tell us who we are, what we are, how we should be, and saying, you go and take it. And now that you are understanding what privilege is about, now you are suffering from knowing how hurtful life has been. It's no fun to be lied to. I don't care what side you're on. We've all been lied by the powers, the church for one, and the kings and queens, and then the governors of the colonies. We want your land. Take it. It's yours. Never, and if you don't take it, guess what? You're not going to have your farm. You're not going to have your, you're not going to have your food supply. Go and harvest this land. And if that means annihilating people, so be it. And I know when Native people were dying left and right from the different diseases that came over on the ships, the people were saying that, well, see, our God is stronger than their God because look, they're dying. And this was something that motivated people to feel okay about moving forward and taking over the land, the property, because literally there were people laying dead who had caught smallpox, were literally dead, and they weren't even buried. There was one story of a fellow who a lot of Native people were taken back to England as show and tell. They would come back years later, and the coastline that they knew had homes on it and a thriving community, it was literally covered with carcasses of humans, of Native people. And we don't hear these stories because we're afraid of the truth. And it's not anybody's fault. It's the fault of the powers that rule us. And so when I see the powers of people in like the program that say you got to find a higher power, and they're kind of twisting it like it's a God thing, the sky daddy bit. You got to get into that, or you're gonna suffer and start drinking again. And I say that's the old thinking. You got to do this. You got to do that, or else you'll be punished. And I don't get that anymore. I have to just say, okay, good for you. Keep it to yourself. Don't try to influence me because you're gonna get a pushback, and we don't want to get into that. And I definitely want to leave people alone because eventually we're all gonna die with our pushbacks and our willpower and our thoughts. So that clarifies that. So I'm just really interested in how, I mean, the secular population in AA has blossomed because we're starting to understand who we are, where we came from, what we want, what we don't want. And what we don't want is just as valid as what we do want. Because you got to know what you don't want if you want to discover what you want. We have to be critical. We have to be mindful. We know what's out there. We know what forces are out there that are forcing the hand of voters, for instance. We know that. There's not much we can do. It's hard. It's a hard mind to bend. And yet at the same time, I don't want to. Because, like I said, we will all eventually die, and whole crop of new generations of people will emerge. I don't know. Didn't know I was going to go into colonization, the American colonies, but it's fascinating how it's carried on through, just even little things like watching Red Skelton as a kid, and he would always say, "God bless." And it was just kind of, even as a little kid, it's like, okay, it just, it's, people, I don't know. I want people to be happy. And I guess if it makes them happy, of course they can believe in whatever they want to believe. And I need to believe in whatever I need to believe. Because if I don't believe, if I don't have a system of understanding and beliefs for myself, I feel very lost and unsure. And can I write it down what I believe? Yeah, I think I can, but it's more fun just to internalize it and walk around and return the shopping cart to its rightful place at the supermarket, little things like that. I know we all have a story, and some are, you know, very hard and extreme and rich and wonderful. I don't look back at my past as awful, because it brought me to this point where I can freshly say I appreciate all the suffering that my ancestors have gone through, and I appreciate all the suffering that your ancestors have gone through. It brought you here, you know, and when we get to share our, you know, what they call the experience, strength, and hope of who we are. You know, we're quite a happy lot when you think about it, considering all the past traumas our ancestors have gone through. You know, I just have to flip a switch and there's heat. I don't have to chop wood. I don't have to get the mule out. You know, I don't have to go dig for potatoes. It's life is sweet. And now that I'm not drinking, life is even sweeter. And I really enjoy the benefits, the I would say the nectar of not drinking. I have added so much value to my life by how I treated my thoughts, my how I question myself, how I see the world that I like portrayed on television and the commercials and the ads and the news, how the thing that's going on all over the world, the people who just want to have a war. Let's have a war. And here we are just trying to be ourselves and comfortable and enjoy our lives. It's quite dynamic, the two parts that I know I have experienced in myself. One, that I have to see this and somehow be okay with what goes around me in the world. When I was drinking, it was a good excuse, you know, because you find somebody else to drink in a dirty bar. You know, where you, with the bar counter's wet, you put your elbow on it, and now your elbow's all wet from the dirty rag that the bartender swiped, you know, and the smell of cigarettes and stuff that didn't quite make it in the ashtray, you know, all that stuff. And we would drink because I, as a, when I was drinking, needed any reason to drink. And it's interesting, the choices I made to the same problems that I had in my early 20s and 30s, they're still out there. People are still killing people left and right. People are still going to wars, creating wars. And yet I'm not drinking because of that. And I'm not drinking because of anything. It's a very interesting, realm to be in. It's kind of Twilight Zone-y, you know, it's like very ironic. There's so many things that you would think, you know, we've heard, you know, if you live my life, you drink too. That kind of logic. I get it. Sure. People do that. But somehow something clicked in me. I remember the last drink I had. I had stopped drinking for about 7, maybe 6 or 7 days because my roommate was starting to go to AA. So in support, I was not going to drink. But, you know, being a good alcoholic, I decided to have one beer. And when I had that first swig of that Dos Equis, it was like literally a veil of grayness coming over me. And I was suddenly feeling that depressed, you know, that just, it was really an interesting feeling, like whoa, like somebody just pressed down on me, on my shoulders. And luckily, and because I had those few moments of clarity and I heard the words about AA, luckily I saw that beer and just that little bit of beer left missing from the neck of that bottle. I realized my problem is that beer. And that, damn it, I'm gonna have to go to AA. Then too late, 2 days later, I went to AA. And then I had a one mini slip with a marijuana joint, little roach. I was cleaning the loft. I was living in Brooklyn, and there was a little roach sitting there on the ground all by itself, and it just jumped up into my mouth got lit, and I inhaled it, and I went to the movies. And that was the only slip. And I went to go see Who's Afraid of Roger Rabbit. I think that was the movie. So I changed my date. 12 years later, I changed my date. That's ego for you. That's fear for you. That's the sense of what are people going to say, which is my family. Don't have anybody over so nobody can say anything bad. Keep your mouth shut. It's a harsh world. So I changed my date to August, 12 years later, and then all of a sudden everybody started going like, oh, I wonder if those pain pills I took were should I change my date, this and that and forth, and I said, well, it was my conscience was bothering me for 12 years, and it was okay because my father had died previous year, and I didn't know he had died because I left California without telling anybody, and he came in the middle of the morning, just his face, to tell me everything's okay, everything's fine. And then I had this incredible urge to finally call, and it was my brother answered that our father had died a month earlier. It took about a month for me to call, so I knew he was dead, but I couldn't verify it until my brother told me that he had died. And the look on my father's face was, it's okay. Everything's fine. You're going to be okay. Nothing to worry about. That kind of look that parents give their 2-year-olds, that kind of thing. So that was really helpful. And so I got sober a year after my alcoholic father died. And then a few years later, my brother died from alcoholism, where he was bleeding pretty much out of every orifice below the waist. And he finally died of a stroke. And my mother died before my father and my brother died. She died of cancer. And if I hadn't have left town, if I hadn't have left town, if I hadn't have left town when I was 18, I think I would have been just like them. I would have been sick. I would have been, I probably would have gotten pregnant or something like that, and because I never wanted children, because I knew they'd wind up in foster care. I knew my ego was so strong that I could not take care of a child. So anyway, words of screwy wisdom. Don't drink and don't drive, make your life your own precious treasure. Go ahead and be crazy and have wild thoughts about life. Make up stories. Because really, when I look back in my ancestry and all that, no one was relaying to my parents and their parents what was going on, And here I am left seeing my life as like a blank page in a way, my past. Ancestry.com, please. I mean, a DNA test. That's all I got going for that part. I just have my childhood to remember. And who knows how much is something accurate? Accurate enough that I can tell the story, but where my life really moved was where it really pivoted was that recognizing that beer is causing me to feel miserable. And something switched and said, I don't want to be miserable anymore. I've lost my father and my mother. Oh, and their ashes were scattered over Donner Summit, over the parking lot, over the Donner Pass. Because I thought that was appropriate. But, it's not that I say to, well, yeah, make up your life, create it. It's yours to create. Who said that we were stuck with what we are? Who said that we can't do this or can't do that? My goodness, most people can't do what we're doing right now on the Zoom calls. We're not drinking alcohol. We're not getting high. Somehow we're managing our somehow we're managing our presence in this world, our now in this world. And we're doing it because obviously there must be benefits to being sober. There has to be value. Or I'd go back out and drink again if this, if I wasn't benefiting from it. And like I said, all the little things, the good things that the, not waking up, wondering where my wallet is or wondering where I parked the car. Did I insult somebody? Did somebody hurt me? Or, what's that bruise on my leg? Did I fall? Where I threw up, and all those things. Out getting arrested for drunk driving, that was always a treat. And just that weird, for me, that weird tunnel vision that I had when I was drinking, because I didn't have any experiences with people. I didn't know how to be around people. And so people were awkward around me. Can you imagine? I can't blame them for seeing me as weird and stupid because I hadn't figured out why I couldn't, maintain that kind of information in my head, whatever. But that's all past. And that's the beautiful thing about there's a past from which I can grow on because I'm sober. And the future is unknown, but what I do now in the present moment in the time, I can think like a day ahead, maybe 2 days ahead. I can look at the weather, say, oh, it's going to be sunny here in the Catskills. We're going to go skiing because, and so that I can figure. But what happens there is a whole nother story. But I can, those kinds of things. I'm just really happy being sober. I'm really happy to see all your faces. And I'm really happy to have been invited. Nowhere else in the world is life like this where we share. And I want to hear from all of you about what you are experiencing in your sobriety. And that's it. Boom.